begin tonight, Mike, how would you feel like to share with us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. One of the questions we talked about is, well, what, why am I invited to speak about race, faith, and Indigenous peoples? So quickly about myself, I am actually an Indigenous person. I'm a fair-skinned Cree man, product of the fur trade. On both sides of my family, I'm both Scottish and Cree, from Manitoba, northern Manitoba. I'm a member of the Peguis First Nation in central Manitoba near the south, and my mother is from the Norway House Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. And so I've been living here in British Columbia most of my life. Eventually went off to university and became a lawyer, and I specialize in the area of Indigenous people and the law, and natural resources, Indigenous rights, and business, that sort of thing. But done so in trying to work through how that deals with my faith. I've studied theology before university and was grappling with my faith and my Indigenous identity and issues that have formed the fabric of Canada, which I've been struggling with throughout my whole career. And then more recently, struggling about how to express my faith and my indigeneity, if that's a word, inside a church, which is continues to be a challenge. So in that regard, I want to honor 10th in making Indigenous issues a priority and an important thing, not just one sermon every year on and around National Aboriginal Day, but a series on relating to race, like other race issues, and importance in around the concepts of reconciliation. So that's kind of why I'm here and how I got here. So and thanks for bringing me here. I'm happy to share what I can with the little bit of time that is available to you.
So there are some false narratives, in our society about faith and race and Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And Mike, what have you noticed about these false narratives in our society and perhaps in the church as well?
Certainly. I didn't want this talk to be about, well, don't say this phrase or that word, or, have a discussion around political correctness or being careful in our language. Rather, what I'd like to say is, and I had to make notes because this is a deeply personal thing for me to discuss. It overlaps myself and who I do and what I believe so deeply, and I speak an awful lot, and very rarely do I speak with notes, so I'm having to rely on notes. When we talk about racism, racism is often based around people speaking really based on things that are not true. Why do we say and do what we say and do? When we say things, do we always intentionally mislead or lie? Most of us don't. I've met a couple of pathological liars in my life, and they're quite unpleasant people, but they're extremely rare. And for the most part, we're not all pathological liars. Yet racism still exists, and in a micro way, in so many different ways. If you're looking at things from an Indigenous lens, you see it more often than you might. In the Indigenous context, I think there's important reasons that we need to discuss the root causes of racism, and that's untruths or false narratives. And unfortunately, we say things because we assume certain things to be true, and they are simply not true. And we often don't recognize that we're basing our views or opinions on lies that have been fed to us all, not just recently, but for hundreds of years. And I'd like to unpack just a couple of those lies that go to the heart of the very legal, political, economic, social, and even the spiritual fabric of this country, that we simply assume to be true when in fact they're not true. So I'd rather hope to assist you in seeing the history of Canada, the current systems we live in, and our daily interactions with that different lens to start looking at things differently. That's really what I'd like to focus in on. And so identifying some of these lies, but then replacing those lies with truth. And then thirdly, saying, well, what does Jesus, who is truth, how does that impact, and the gospel impact, how we manage lies and truth in our lives in this indigenous context? So, because for me to simply say, well, don't believe those truths anymore, and then we'll go home, that's not going to work. You need to replace those lies with something else. And all the more so when we're motivated and empowered by the power of the one who is truth himself. So I just want to be encouraging in focusing on that underlying basis for racism. So if I can maybe get into a couple of these truths, or untruths, I guess. Well, we don't have a lot of time, so this is really just a high-level introductory commentary. The biggest lie from an Indigenous perspective is this concept of terra nullius. That's a Latin phrase for empty land, or what people talk about, this doctrine of discovery. Now, it's wonderful that the 10th is doing the series on that film, Doctrine of Discovery, to say, well, let's watch it together, let's think about it, let's talk about it. And so many people who are academics and lawyers and Indigenous leaders and Indigenous people of Indigenous followers of Christ involved in that film, saying that this was a really harmful thing, and to name it. And it goes, so what is the doctrine of discovery? It goes back to when Christopher Columbus discovered North America. And we still use the word discovered, but we shouldn't. Did you know that in 1491, or even 1492, over 100 million people lived in North America? And there were no Europeans at the time. Those people living here, my own nations included, lived as independent nations in organized societies and structures, speaking numerous different languages, expressing culture, and living out their lives with their own spiritual values. Then how can we possibly talk about discovery? And the Pope at the time decreed that the land claimed by European nations as their own was empty land, was terra nullius. So it's hard to think about it, because it's hard not to take that concept personally as an Indigenous person, as a Cree person. Because what the Pope said, this leader of this Christian faith at the time, the Pope said is that those people were not actually people. Like they had to, and that was a legal lie. And not that they were other nations that would be, say, conquered or treated with or to be evangelized, but no, they didn't exist as people. It didn't exist as societies or as cultures. Therefore, from a legal standpoint, even spiritual standpoint, the land was empty. Now, if you read, and we'll talk about it later, a little bit later, is if you read in John 4 about Jesus speaking to the woman at the well, the Samaritan, there was a distinct friction between Samaritans and Jews. But Samaritans were people. Indigenous people, according to the Pope at the time, said we weren't even Samaritans. That's what the doctrine of discovery says. Now, what are the implications of it? And we're still living with those implications here today. Just trying to go back to my notes here. So, this doctrine of discovery means that we were not human beings made in the image of God, who a European Christian then could express out their faith as their neighbor, as described in the New Testament. And please think about the deep and centuries-old implications of how this plays out as to the ownership and jurisdiction of lands, oceans, rivers, and lakes. And we've been thinking a lot about the rivers and lakes lately with the flooding. And think about how the indigenous people are a problem to be managed then, while discovery and settlement is ongoing. This makes it then potentially, conceptually easier to confine indigenous people to the reserve lands and institute a past system so they could not leave the reserve without approval, denying them property rights of any kind to own real estate, denying them rights of citizenship or the right to vote, to join a profession. So I couldn't have been a lawyer until 1960 as an indigenous person, to enter a restaurant or a pub, to fish or hunt for your historic traditional livelihood, and otherwise maintain your spiritual and cultural connection to the land that you and your ancestors have lived on for thousands of years without fear of prosecution for a criminal offense, for denying legal counsel for indigenous nations to raise claims for land, against the lands and the rights, for denying the ability to even raise funds for non-indigenous people to support fundraising for those claims. And of course, we've learned more in the news in this last 6 months about the denial of the human dignity, culture, and identity of children, and to be maintained in their connection with their families, their communities, through the imposition of the residential schools. Now, I didn't make one of those things up. That's Canada. That's the history we share. Now, how can we possibly justify all of those things? And it's because of this lie that is terra nullius, that is the doctrine of discovery, or this empty land, the denial that indigenous people are human beings, that we have cultures, we have identities, and therefore a relationship to land, have nationhood. And so it seeps its way through history, this lie, and it comes out in today. And so little things are said that rely on that lie that have the impact as indigenous people as being racist. So that's just one of the big lies that I think are important. And I think we need to ask ourselves, you know, what is the underlying basis for these views, right? I have two more lies, if I can go on. The other one is this anthropological lie. And it's about this concept of civilization. When my great-grandfather arrived in Scotland as a 16-year-old or 18-year-old and to join the Hudson Bay, he had a diary. And he was writing his diary about his trip over, and eventually became quite a high-ranking Hudson Bay manager. Well, in his diary, he referred to Indigenous people, one of whom he eventually married and had an Indigenous family himself. He referred to, and we were met by some very friendly savages. He used the word savages, which was common, right? And there's this concept of a value system that we place on different levels of progression of societies. And in a recent book entitled The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, authors and academics David Graeber and David Wengrow published the research that was 10 years in the making to clearly and unequivocally state what Indigenous people have known all along, that the other big lie is about the concept of civilizations and the values we place on those societies, societal structures. Academics, starting with Rousseau and Hobbes, and there's a lot of younger people here, probably academics or recent academics, have long since created this development or advancement theory or perception of societies, from hunter-gatherers to agrarian to industrial to technological stages, with values and importance assessed to each quote-unquote stage. Yet, is that even true? And of course it's not true. And Graeber and Wengrow state clearly that this is simply not true. Moreover, they state that this lie has devastating political consequences, and which we know, being a colonial country. And finally, they say this untrue history paints our society and history in far too boring a light. We are, after all of us, quite interesting and colorful and different peoples. We have so many different, interesting, fascinating cultures. And in a different life, had I not been called to work in this battle of Indigenous issues, I might have been an anthropologist just out of pure curiosity. Yet, it was not that recently stated that we have to help civilize the savages, that we have to assist Indigenous development. You know, that's a softer way approach. Or, even more recently, that we have to help raise capacity of Indigenous peoples. That the Indian Act, at its first inception, wasn't called the Indian Act. It was called something around the Act for the Act established for the civilization and advancement of the Indian. That's really what it was called. And so what are the implications of this anthropological lie? Well, there are a lot, but just a couple of them would be that this justifies kind of a moral justification for the development and advancement of the resources and lands in Canada. That if we can create this development and advance things along, then it might not matter as much that the land has been stolen, or the lands have not been treated, or the lands that were treated the treaties have not been lived up to. And so, in fact, our society is based on this concept of advancement and development. And we believe this lie, and we continue to propagate the lie in the face of the history of the country. So Indigenous peoples know that that's simply not true. And so I've kind of talked about big picture, but what about the church? And this is kind of a sensitive, more sensitive lie that I've experienced. This is my own personal view, obviously. The other big lie is about helping people and who needs that help. And it's about concepts of independence, autonomy, and control. And this, I think, underlies most of the kind of subtle racism within the church, in my experience. And this is a lie that Indigenous people aren't capable. They don't know what they need or what's best for them, and they need non-Indigenous people to help them. That is something that filters down over the decades. And that the lie continues that only non-Indigenous people have the resources, the know-how, or the motivation to kind of fix Indigenous people, to help them and make them proper Canadians or proper Christians. And that's what I've experienced. And it's very, very subtle. And yet there's a lack of a recognition or appreciation for the importance and significance of Indigenous culture, identity, and spirituality. Yes, spirituality that can live and coexist inside a follower of Christ. But have we given thought to that possibility, to those notions? In a large way, the answer is no. And that's why most non-Indigenous people that encounter Indigenous people and catch a glimpse for maybe the injustice, the poverty, the social ills that we are facing as a result of the intergenerational trauma that's occurred. As a first step, many Indigenous people, non-Indigenous people, want to do something, I want to help, like a project or a ministry or a box to be checked. But this is often done without a full understanding of Indigenous people's history, the true relationships or partnerships that are required with Indigenous peoples, or any initiative led or run by Indigenous peoples. There's numerous Christian ministries out there that don't have a significant Indigenous involvement, perspective, support, or decision making. And so I've given a talk with the Law Society involved as a lawyer, and on intercultural competency training for legal counsel. And in an interview, I said, I've had, in a way, not that I'm that old, but I've had 100 years, you know, we've had 100 years of that help, you know. I don't need another 150 years of someone trying to fix me or save me or help me. I don't. That's the job of Christ in my life. That's the power of the Creator living in me. And my First Nation, my extended family, my more immediate family, in a lot of different ways, we've all suffered different types of harm. And it's significantly impacted and broken apart our family, and that lack of healing that is still yet to occur. And rather, I'd appreciate the room and respect to live my life and as an Indigenous person and have a friend and partner with me as we move forward together. That's what Indigenous Christians are seeking. And I'd much rather have your tender-hearted understanding and friendship than anything. And that's where I think it needs to start. And there's that's more valuable than an apology or you feeling guilty or anything like that. This is not an effort on my part to make you feel guilty. I mean, this is to make you think differently, you know, that Indigenous people were still here. We are still here. We are precious and sacred in the sight of the Creator. We have hearts burning for seeking after a relationship with the land and the Creator and each other. And so those are the kind of the three big lies that are kind of out there. I have this other comments on systemic racism that I could talk about a little bit more, but I thought I would just kind of answer that first big question by saying, well, those are the big ones. But the they filter down into our everyday lives. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, and thank you for helping us to learn, right? And we need to recognize these lies before we can do anything about them and try to learn and try to take a step forward. So thank you for sharing that with us.
So that was the lie portion of my comments. Now, what about truth? And because we need to replace that with a different narrative. And because me saying that makes me sound like I'm making a political pitch. I'm talking like a politician or like an Indigenous leader. But here I am in a church. What does Scripture say about this? What does Jesus' guidance provide us? And we're asked to, I think Proverbs talks about how we're called to speak truthfully and fairly, to speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. I mean, I happen to be as fair as I am, an Indigenous person who's fairly well-educated, who's, after 32 years, I can use words as a legal counsel, I'd be an advocate. I'm called to say what I have to say. But we're all called to speak truthfully. You know, when these comments come out, we're called to say, no, that's not true. You can't say that. So we need to move forward from lies to truth. Jesus is filled with grace and truth, not projects and truth, not funding and truth, not paternalistic help and truth, but grace. And grace is I thought I was thinking, what is grace? In its relationship with truth, what is grace? Grace is humility, tenderness, and compassion all wrapped together. And you can call someone out on something. You can speak truthfully with grace because that's what Jesus did. And it starts by listening with your heart and your head and relearning history and facts and then approaching truth with grace. I was thinking about Jesus in preparing for these comments, and that is, I guess in a way he was a cross-cultural expert by necessity and survival. He was born into a dominant Roman rule and fled the country and grew up in his early years in Egypt, another country, another society, another culture. And only later in his younger life returned to Israel. He was an immigrant in his own land. And so he saw different races through his life. He was a cross-cultural expert. He was a wanderer in different cultural contexts. And I feel an affinity to that because I don't feel like I've got one foot in different contexts. So getting back to our mandate, Ephesians 4:24 requires us to put off falsehood and speak truthfully to our neighbor, for we're all one body. And the purpose of speaking truthfully with grace is unity. And so what can we focus on replacing these false narratives with? Well, getting back to basics, Christ died for all. Yes, all of us. We are, unlike that papal decree, we are all people. We are all worthy of the love of Christ. I was I want that to sink in. On the plane coming home from a weekend I had in Edmonton, I was talking about this sense that Indigenous people feel and believe the lie too. And it hurts. When I was a lawyer for 10 years, had a very successful career, and continued that, and working in these big firms, doing all this stuff, making decent money. We lived in Tawas, and Leanne said, I'll meet you and the kids. The kids and I will meet you down in Beech Grove at Centennial Park. The tide is just coming in. The sun has baked the sand all day. It's like bathwater. The sun is going down. There's a shop there that sells fish and chips. I'll bring your shorts and your casual clothes. So I drove straight from downtown Vancouver and met them there. And then I began to cry because I said, I don't deserve this. I don't feel like I deserve this. But I went to law school like everyone else, and I worked hard, and I paid those bills, and but I actually felt I didn't deserve this. And I also felt survivor guilt from my Indigenous friends who didn't make it. Like, they went to law school with me, they became lawyers, and some of them died because of health issues or personal issues that became substance issues that were not able to practice law after a while, and I was kind of there by myself, my dear friends. So these lies impact Indigenous people in a very deep, personal way. We are all worthy of the love of Christ. We all have souls. We are all made in His image. And one day Christ will bring all nations and their cultures to Himself, where we will celebrate and rejoice together in heaven, worshiping the giver of life and truth. Now, the other thing that I wanted to add to this renewed narrative is that in many Indigenous cultures, we believe in a creator God, a monotheistic religion. We don't worship creation. We worship the creator. That creation is a precious gift to mankind, and it is sacred. That every human being is sacred because it comes from the Creator. That human beings are not perfect. This is the spiritual teachings I've been taught. And they're not perfect, thus we require renewal and humility over and over again. Thus, so many ceremonies are focused on humility and gratitude and renewal before the Creator. And that's the heart of the tobacco and sage ceremonies, is renewal, gratitude, and humility, because we know that before the Creator, we are not perfect. And the seven laws are that we often call the grandfathers that teach us, they flow from the land. You know, when you read in Romans chapter 1 about the evidence of God's existence comes from creation. The land is our teacher. The land teaches us these seven laws of love, respect, humility, courage, wisdom, and honesty. And we also believe in the continued existence of life after death. We also believe that we need to be caretakers of the land and the waters, because that's a sacred duty that's given to us by their Creator. Does any of what I just said conflict with scriptural teachings? I don't think so. Yet, that narrative is not out there. That is what needs to replace those big lies. And the concept of restoring cultures, restoring nations, in my view, is as much an effort in advancing the gospel as anything. When we take the looking at our perspective of truth and grace and indigenous peoples, then we have to be advocates and support. I just want to finish up and talk about what Jesus did in John chapter 4 when he met the woman at the well. And how did Jesus speak across a culture, across a people group? Well, the first thing he did was he went there. And the second thing he did was that he was so incredibly humble. And he asked the person at the lowest end of the social ladder for help. Have we ever even considered approaching indigenous peoples that way? I don't think we have. And he spoke truth into this individual woman's life, but he didn't answer the questions about the division between Jews and Samaritans. If you read that, read it again. He didn't answer her question about worship. He didn't judge the worship about whose worship is right or wrong. He didn't judge the need and importance of the worship of God. And neither should we judge the worship of indigenous peoples in their desire to seek after God. Rather, he established a connection. He, in fact, revealed himself once establishing that connection, and once they started having that heart conversation, he revealed himself as the Messiah. Like, that's amazing that he did that to her and not to so many other people back in Israel. And are we willing to be that humble? Can we approach indigenous peoples that way? Can we go there? Can we ask for help? Can we honor indigenous people by asking for help with what they know and have to offer? Like, we know a lot about the land and the environment. In fact, we're experts in it. We know about the importance of interrelationship and interdependence and kinships, because that's the way we look at society. We don't see it as all about individual rights, me, me, me. We have so much to learn from indigenous people. And can we get to a place where we can begin those conversations and have those heart languages? You know, what's your heart language conversation? You know, what brings you to Jesus? What brought you to Jesus? What brings you to Jesus now? Is it something about your health, about your family? Is it about addiction or recovery? Is it about decolonization and rethinking new ways to live together in society? Like, what does your coffee talk look like? And how might you learn from indigenous peoples so much that you can begin to have those heart-to-heart conversations with indigenous peoples where Jesus reveals himself to you and to others in that clear and tender way he revealed himself to the woman at the well, once we get there? And so my prayer is that the Lord will reveal in a personal and tender way as we begin those relationships with indigenous people. Lord, make us humble. Lord, make us needy and eager to learn and be from indigenous people, to rely on indigenous people and give and begin those conversations. Lord, open those doors, open our hearts and minds and fill them up with your truth. You are the very yourself, Jesus, the truth, with grace, and cast out those lies and help us to renew that commitment regularly. That's my prayer for myself as a sufferer of the lies, but as a person of faith and wanting to express my indigeneity inside a church. So I think I'm tremendously grateful to be able to say the stuff out loud that I've been carrying for a long time, but trying to figure out the right way to say it. And I'm so grateful that 10th is taking a leadership role and saying, we got to talk about this. Let's tackle it. Let's go there. And I just continue to pray for 10th that we will somehow open those doors. Thank you.